It's member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, all things considered, and I'm Dave Lawrence. Thank you for joining us today, talking with one of the folks who's been involved in the remarkable, I guess you would say, resurgence with the Sumatran rhinoceros. And it's Dr. Terry Roth from the Cincinnati Zoo, taking some time to fill in some of the picture, considerable picture, relating to these creatures and the miraculous activities that have been going on recently. Of course, a new birth that has just happened, and the reason that we've got her on the line right now. Dr. Roth, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dave.
And it's great to talk to you now. Your official title over there at the Cincinnati Zoo is what?
It's a long one. I'm Vice President of Conservation and Science and the Director of CREW, which is the Center for Conservation and Research of Endangered Wildlife.
That's fantastic. And the significance of the birth. So painting a picture for folks, Sumatran Rhino Sanctuary in Indonesia, where a couple of rhinos that you had a lot to do with are now living. And actually, now it would be four if you count the offspring. So it began, and we'll hear more about the history of some of the other cats, but I believe it was Andalus who went over there first, and then Andalus had an offspring, Andatu. Then you guys gave the blessing for Harapan to go over there, and then Andalus and his significant other, I guess you could call Ratu, now having a second birth. And this one is a female Sumatran rhino. What is the significance of the birth of this still unnamed female?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the birth of a female in particular is just, I mean, it's exactly what we needed more than anything else. Considering there's only 100 of these rhinos, approximately 100 left, any healthy calf is much needed for the population. But because we have now three males at the sanctuary, we really needed a female. And that's one of those things that, you know, we only have control over so many things, and that is not one of them. And so it's kind of one of those things that's just left to fate. But this time, I think fate actually smiled down upon us for a short period of time at least. And We're just thrilled to have a female calf.
And now that means what? That there's genetic diversity? That the males, the names, since there's only six, it's sort of easy to keep track of, I guess. It's Bina is one of the females, Rosa and Ratu, those are the three females?
Those are the three females, correct, yes.
And then we have three males in order of their age would be Andalus, Harapan, and then Andalus's baby boy, Andatu.
Andatu, correct.
And then, so now there are seven, though, with the arrival of this new female. So they have a total of seven at this facility now.
Yeah, now there are seven. There are three others in captivity that are in Sabah, Malaysia. But two of those are females that are considered non-reproductive because of the pathology they've developed in their reproductive tracts. At the Sumatran Rhino Sanctuary itself, those three females, we believe one of them is too old and will never reproduce at this point. So we really only have two potential breeders, and that's why adding this new calf gives us a third one, and it's just so important for the population.
That demonstrates how critical it is. So essentially, the other three that are in captivity elsewhere in Indonesia, none of those females are capable of breeding, and then of now there are a total of four females at the facility, the SRS, that you're more closely involved in. And at that, one of those not capable of breeding, but to the best of your knowledge, well, obviously Ratu is capable of breeding, Rosa, and then we hope for this new female. I know it's several years for a turnaround time before Ratu would be ready again, but is she still capable of coming up with a potential third calf?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. We don't know her exact age because she did come in from the wild as an adult, but we think she was pretty young when she came in, but she was sexually mature. So, our estimate, the numbers bounce around a little bit, but I think the estimates are anywhere from 14 to 17 years old, and they should, if they stay healthy, they should be able to continue reproducing up into the late 20s, maybe even into her 30s.
How long do they live?
Well, you know, it's the Sumatran rhinos, and we don't know for sure, but we have had a couple that we know lived into their 30s. So whether or not they can make it to 40, I couldn't answer that, but it's possible.
Well, it certainly puts a light on how critical it is and why literally everyone must be just handling every one of these guys with kid gloves. The other facility that has the three, are you at all involved with, or is that, like, whose control are they in?
They're actually run by a conservation organization called BORA, the Borneo Rhino Alliance. And so, but we are definitely in touch with those folks. Typically when I go over there, or often when I go over there, I do touch base with them as well. So we've had some involvement, even though our closest ties are obviously to Indonesia, and the exchange of the rhinos all occurred between the United States and Indonesia. Malaysia wasn't really a part of that. So that's our stronger relationship. And the fact that now Malaysia has basically declared the Sumatran rhino extinct in their country kind of puts all the focus on Indonesia.
Certainly does. Is the male that's part of that group of three able to reproduce, and is there going to be any use of him for that?
There are mixed reviews about that male. We believe he can reproduce. He certainly has been checked out. Some say he might be subfertile, but I'm not sure we really know that. And since he's with two females that are basically thought to be infertile, there's no way to test it while he's over there.
We're talking about reproduction of the Sumatran rhino, and literally from everything I've read and seen, without you, there wouldn't be any of it happening. And it's, it's a pretty big gift you've given to the world. I'm sure a lot of people have thanked you already. Please definitely accept mine, because they are so lovable. When you just see hairpin, that's really the animal that made me fall in love with rhinos and want to find out about this incredible crisis which is going on. And so dialing in on your groundbreaking discovery that you made in Cincinnati that first enabled the breeding of the Sumatran rhinos, explain what you did.
Well, I guess the key to the species was integrating the science into the breeding program. They're very difficult to monitor just behaviorally, because they don't show the obvious signs of estrus, or the female does not show when she's really obviously going to be receptive to the male, like we see in our dogs and cats, where you can just tell. So with none of the behavioral cues and with no existing information about the reproductive physiology of the species, you're kind of working blind, and you can't simply house them together because they're solitary animals and they fight with each other if you put them together. So it really became a game of trying to figure out the reproductive physiology so that we knew the exact day or potentially days that the female would be receptive to the male. We could put them together, and even though there might be a little bit of scuffling, they would breed instead of just fighting and hurting each other. And so that just really evolved around hormone monitoring, and we did a lot of ultrasound work where we actually could look directly at the ovaries and see what was developing on those ovaries. And a mixture of that with the management of the animals, and eventually we learned that part of the reason it was so difficult was because this is a species that's an induced ovulator, which means she only ovulates when she's introduced to a male for breeding. And as long as people are keeping them separate, she's not going to ovulate, and you're never going to learn much about her reproductive cycle. So, it took a bit of creativity and a bit of trial and error, which is what usually happens with science. But eventually we did figure it all out, and we know exactly how long their reproductive cycle is. And so we know now if they're put in with a male and they do breed successfully and ovulate, then we know that 21 days later, they are very, very likely to be ready to breed again if they didn't conceive. And that helps guide us. And we can also just use the ultrasound. We can look at the ovaries when a follicle, a developing egg, reaches a certain size. We know that's the day to put them together, regardless of their behavior. If they're showing no interest in each other, we put them together anyway, and usually within a couple hours, they're breeding.
Amazing. And you had, prior to discovering this with them, had you worked on other rhinos and basically in general, taking a step back, is one of your specialties as a doctor and scientist in reproduction of animals?
Yes, I'm definitely a reproductive physiologist. And I had started working on rhinos, but only about a year, year and a half before moving to the Cincinnati Zoo. And so it was really still new to me, but we knew a lot more about the African rhino species than the Asian rhino species. And so when I arrived at Cincinnati and the zoo director said that the highest priority was to breed these Sumatran rhinos, I kind of had to switch gears and focus on this new species that nobody really knew anything about. So I was kind of starting at ground zero.
How is the ovulation of the Sumatran rhino different than other rhinos?
Well, for example, the black rhinos and white rhinos, which have been studied for a long time, most people knew that black rhinos will typically cycle about every 21 to 25 days. And we knew that white rhinos would cycle approximately every 35 days. That's the kind of, and you could tell that because whether they were put with a male or not, you could tell by their hormone patterns what was going on. And again, because the Sumatran rhino would not ovulate without being put with a male, you really could not map out her cycle.
And you guys, you were the first one when Ondalis was born in 2001, I guess it was. You were that was the very first one born in captivity in what, like 100 years or something?
Yeah, it was the first one. There was one on record 112 years earlier that apparently was born at the Calcutta Zoo. And that was the only record of a Sumatran rhino that was bred and born in captivity. I think they captured. There were a few that were captured and brought into captivity back in history that gave birth after being captured pregnant. But for one to be, and in fact, when we were monitoring our first pregnancy, the only information I could find about pregnancy in a Sumatran rhino claimed it was a 7-month gestation.
Wow.
which we didn't really believe, but that's the kind of information that was out there because just nobody knew. It was still a secret.
Right. So, I mean, that's one of the things I'm trying to point out is that without what you discovered, basically, I mean, you took over 100-year gap and you closed that gap with your discovery, essentially.
Yeah, you could say that. You know, the other interesting thing is just mapping out their cycles and figuring out how to breed them wasn't the only problem. It's that they seem to be really susceptible to pregnancy loss. And I don't know if you've picked up on that in what you've read about them. Here in Cincinnati, when our female first became pregnant, she lost her first pregnancy and went on to lose 4 more pregnancies. So we went through 5, basically, miscarriages. All within the first 3 months of gestation. So it's very early in their pregnancy, but they seem really, it seems to be a real sensitive period. And so that was like a roller coaster because that was over a period of several years. And this was before any calf, you know, we're still trying to work on producing the first calf from this program, and we kept losing them. And we wouldn't have even known that if we had not been doing the ultrasounds on her because you can see an embryo very early on in pregnancy in these rhinos. But if you're not checking them that way, you wouldn't have even known this was happening. But we had to put her on a hormone supplement in order to, before she finally carried her 6th pregnancy to term.
And that's part of the secret which goes towards Ratu's success, right? Both of these times she's been on that hormone supplement.
Exactly. And so that, I think, was kind of an eye-opener for our colleagues because I think most folks just thought it was a problem with this one rhino we had in Cincinnati. And then when Ratu got pregnant for the first time, she did exactly the same thing, and she lost her pregnancy in the first 3 months. So the beauty of it is that, of course, we had experienced it all in Cincinnati already, and so we had the answer. Well, here's the template. This is what we did for our animal. You can try the exact same dose and the same hormone and see what happens. And sure enough, then they were able to produce their first pregnancy back in 2012. But this time they chose not to even take a chance. They just put her on the hormone as soon as we diagnosed that pregnancy last winter.
Okay, so you're saying the first time that Ondalis and Ratu mated, they didn't take it. They didn't use the hormone treatment that you had used with, I guess it was Emmy.
Right, and that goes back to 2010. When there was a pregnancy we announced back in 2010, and then within a month of announcing it, she had lost it.
And then they began using the hormone for the next one going forward.
And then I think she even lost one more after that. And then the third time when she bred, they put her on the hormone supplement, and that's when she carried on Datu to term.
Amazing. And is that something that needs to be provided from elsewhere? Can they just get that on their own there in Indonesia?
Sometimes you can get it over in Southeast Asia, but not all the time.
So, hey, in addition to their low numbers, is it also true in general that it would be, even on their own, also because they can't find each other in their disconnected jungle communities, it's in general, they're harder to breed than other rhinos?
Yeah, the Sumatran rhino has been harder to breed than other rhinos because of their lifestyle, because they're so solitary. And, you know, you go to Africa and you'll see rhinos, usually in somewhat group-like settings. The black rhino is a little more solitary than the white rhino. The white rhino can run in big herds. But these guys, no, they do not hang out together. And so they're difficult for us to breed in captivity, but we're also seeing a decline in reproduction in the wild populations because as the habitat gets fragmented, their territories become reduced, and then they don't cross each other's paths as much. And it's critical that a male crosses a female's path just as she's coming into estrus so that he does meet up with her and breed with her on the right day. I mean, the right day, it's only about a 24-hour period, so you don't have a lot of latitude there.
So without human intervention, this species is really going to be, it will go extinct without, because the odds, as you're pointing out, that they're going to cross paths in that one 24-hour window seems pretty slim unless you were to have a program where you were able to do this yourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I think more and more people are starting to come to that realization. I've seen a real interesting turnaround with this program since I started. You know, I've been involved with it since 1996. And at that point in time, there was incredible criticism about the captive breeding effort. And I've seen it almost do a complete 180. I mean, today I hear more people saying that the only way we're going to save them is through captive breeding than I could ever have imagined. And I'm just thankful that we aren't starting from square one right now. And at least, you know, we started back in the 1980s bringing a few animals into captivity so that we could learn all this, because it's been a really steep learning curve. And the tendency with endangered species is people wait too long. And then you're down to just a handful of animals, and you don't have all the science, and you don't understand them, and you're asked to save them. And then you're just faced with an impossible situation. So I'm hoping that we started early enough with this species that now that we've got the template and we've been able to transfer that, and Indonesia is now doing it, you know, we need that to happen more and more. And hopefully it will help us, because it's really on the verge of extinction.
Why can't they, and forgive me for what may seem like an ignorant question to somebody in your level, why can't they be cloned? You hear about people cloning sheep or cloning other things. Is it just not possible to do that?
That's a loaded question. There are certainly some people in my field, some people in conservation, that think that cloning is going to play a significant role in saving some of these species on the brink of extinction. I like to be open-minded about the potential of science, because I am a scientist, but I also like to be realistic about what seems feasible given the years I've put into this work and all the challenges that we've come up against. And you know, when assisted reproduction became popular for trying to save endangered species, we thought, based on what's happened with our domestic agricultural species, that it was going to be this huge boon to, you know, reproducing these endangered animals by the large numbers very quickly through this technology. It's not turned out to be that way. It is much more challenging than we anticipated. And progress is slower than we anticipated. And when you go to the extreme as far as cloning goes, which is still actually a real struggle with domestic animals, and we've been doing it for a large number of years now, I think we're going to run out of time if we're going to start turning to that kind of technology to save something like the Sumatran rhino. There are just far too many hurdles and far too many unknowns that I think it's going to be very, very difficult. Now, I wouldn't say that it doesn't have a role in some very specific situations, but as a remedy for saving endangered species, I don't think it's the way to go.
And the disease, wasn't there like an iron deficiency or too much iron sort of thing in there that related to their diet? Has that been figured out and solved?
There is an iron storage disease, and it's actually absorbed most of my time for the past 3 years now, because I've really turned more of my attention towards it. It's a problem not just with rhinos, but with a number of wildlife species that come into captive environments and are taken care of in zoos or in sanctuaries. We don't really know why it happens. The easiest thing to turn to is say the diet's not right, but the variety of species that get this disease is so broad that I don't think it's simply just a dietary deficiency or, you know, abundance. And just to give you an idea, these browsing rhinos get iron storage disease, but so do dolphins, and so do many fruit-eating bird species, and so does a primate that comes out of South America, and so do some bats and tapirs. And so it's a long list of species that get the disease. The jury's still out as to what is actually happening and why do they get it. But I'll tell you, it seems like the common denominator is that it affects species that have diets that are inherently low in iron, and they typically come from an environment that's very high in parasite load. So my hunch is that they've probably just evolved to not regulate their iron uptake and to absorb as much iron as they can, because they're more likely to become anemic than anything else. And when we bring them into captivity and we feed them good, healthy diets and we get rid of all their parasites, they no longer have an outlet for that iron, and they can't control their absorption, so they just end up absorbing too much. It's a theory. I don't have any scientific proof of this, but I've given it a lot of thought.
Well, that certainly helps to bolster what you're saying. That, I mean, it's like a gamble. Just having these is nice, but there's no guarantee that one of the ones there at the SRS or the other facility may not succumb to one of these to the iron issue. So, literally, you're not just plagued with their natural passing of creatures, but this condition could even affect one of these handful in captivity. So it really does mean they are literally on the edge of extinction.
Yeah, they are on the edge of extinction. I think with regards to this particular disease, they're less likely to get it being in the rainforest, because they are continually subjected to leeches and ticks and all these things even though they're in the sanctuary, I mean, it's a natural forest.
Right.
So they still have all those things out there.
Which are helpful, then, you're saying, to get it.
And I think, just my opinion, but I do think they're helpful. It's a hypothesis, but I will say that I am not at all convinced that it's a dietary problem. I think it's more of an evolutionary adaptation the species has made to survive where it lives. And then we're bringing it into a different environment. And we're kind of, we're actually causing problems through our kindness because we get rid of all the parasites and we feed them well. So.
Right, and I get you. It's an unintended consequence of trying to take good care of them. It's rare I get to talk to somebody who could put this out there, because I'm doing a series to try to address the rhino poaching crisis and give exposure to what's happening to the rhinos, which is a really frightening situation that they're in right now in Africa, especially where the poaching has increased 6,000% in 8 years. And so on the note of, and we're in the Asia Pacific, so I look at it like a pretty relevant spot for Honolulu, which Hawaii is the third biggest market for ivory in the United States. Thankfully, we've just put a ban on it. Rhino horn obviously could be an element that's being sold here. But when it comes to the rhino horn and this concept that some people have in Asia, in Vietnam and in China, that the horn has some sort of medicinal value, as a scientist and a doctor who's worked with these animals, how do we know the horn has no value? And can you comment on exactly, can you respond to anyone who thinks that it does have a value and kind of give them a scientific answer from your heart that establishes that it does not?
Well, there are studies out there about rhino horn, and to a large extent, most of them say there is absolutely no evidence that it has any medicinal properties. One response would be to say that basically the rhino horn consists of keratin. Keratin is the same thing that is in your fingernails. So if you think that chewing your fingernails is going to help cure your illness, then that's what you should be doing instead of using rhino horn. It's the exact same material. There's a flip side to that, though, because in reality, there's a second market for rhino horn that does not have anything to do with necessarily the medicinal properties of rhino horn. In Vietnam, it's become a status symbol. And so, in high society circles, it seems to be the in thing is to serve rhino tea. And so people are doing it just as a part of their high society image, instead of doing it for medicinal reasons. And that market seems to be exploding. And so it's an added problem for us, because even if we can combat the medical issue by showing data and having studies performed By Asian scientists, not by Westerners. Nobody, that's not going to work. But if we have the Asian scientists do the studies and they do show that there's no medicinal properties, the data indicate it doesn't work, that eventually can help reduce the demand. And that's what has worked in the past when there was years ago when there was a high level of poaching. They did that, and the demand died down a little bit. But now this new uprise in poaching has been driven by this market in Vietnam, and it has nothing to do with the medical properties of rhino horn. So it's actually more difficult to fight.
And so then you're basically saying there's some people who say, because you try to establish as a news person, you look at it, 6,000% increase, 8 years. You look at these numbers very closely, and the only thing I could see from talking to different people and from reading about it, there was some sort of rumor that maybe existed in 2008 that some Vietnamese government minister used the substance, was cured of cancer or some sort of ailment. Because I'm trying to look at what on earth could make something rise so quickly between 2008 and now. Have you heard that theory before? And does that explain some of the use there? Because I understand what you're talking about, and I've heard all about it. People snorting it, people displaying it.
Yeah.
I mean, all these, and which is really kind of ridiculous, because, I mean, how do you even know you're being sold that?
I mean,
it's not like marijuana or something you could clearly look at and go, no, this is marijuana or this is parsley. I mean, how do you even know what's in the bag? But have you heard that rumor about the Vietnamese government minister? And can you point to anything that would establish how this thing took off so quickly?
I can't point to one specific thing. It just seems like it's a combination of factors. I certainly have heard that some folks think that there's this theory it can help cure cancer, and it certainly could have come from exactly that example you just put out there. But I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure. Some of it is also the legal issues at the borders of some of the African countries, and so some of those are too loose, and so it has made it easy for the poachers to get in and out very quickly, especially like going in and out of Kruger National Park, which is why Kruger has been hit so hard with the poaching. So you're relying on the governments of some of those countries to tighten their borders, but of course some of the officials are probably involved, and so it just becomes very, very complex.
Do you support mass translocations, things like the Australian Rhino Project or efforts to, now that it looks like they're really, we're talking 2 to 3 animals every single day, orphans that are being left. Sometimes they die because it's so traumatic for them and they're denied their milk, they're dehydrated, they're injured by other animals. When it comes to efforts by people who seem like they really are organized to take them to safer places, do you support that? And at the same time, there is some sort of talk about possibly legalizing it. South Africa has backed off of that, but they left that possibility open in the future for a legalized trade in the horn. Where do you stand on that as well?
You know, I'd have to say that I do in general, support the idea of insurance populations located in other areas. And I would say that even if it wasn't rhinos and poaching, but for endangered species in general, we've just seen things go badly too quickly when you have these single populations or populations in one country where there's an outbreak of something or that goes awry. So, you know, I've always been a supporter of having these insurance populations. Now, whether or not that's Australia with 1,000 rhinos, you know, somewhere in Australia, or whether that's Texas, or whether that's just the zoo community that has the insurance population, I'm not exactly sure which is the best way to handle that. And all are probably complicated, but I think we should have them in this day and age. I mean, we're not even dealing with, we don't look at countries separately anymore. We are one big global population.
That's right.
So, you know, I just think it really makes sense. And it's kind of like there's a great program in Australia trying to save the Tasmanian devil, and they are purposely sending those animals to Europe and to the United States and to other places so that they have these other pockets of hopefully protected and sustainable populations. And I think that's very smart. With regard to rhino horn, you know, that one is another really complex question about legalization versus not. Everything I have heard, and is all I can do, is pretty much listen to what people on the ground, people in Africa, people you know, involved with farms that have rhinos, what they're saying, and people involved in conservation over the years. And what I've heard is that legalizing it will not help, and in fact, it will hurt. And I think there are examples that the people who have been more closely involved with what's been going on in Africa in history have given me specific examples of when laws became loosened and how the incidence of poaching just increased. It never decreased. So, I would have to say that I do not think we should be legalizing it. I don't think that's going to help.
Okay. No, it sounds, I couldn't agree more. It sounds like it would only feed a demand for something that doesn't even seem, like a strange sort of substance to be consuming. Like I said, there's no verification even with people who are buying it. So I don't see how it would tamper down the demand. It is one of those interesting things. And hopefully they can get more of them out of there. It doesn't look like they can really secure them very well in South Africa. I'm having that guy from the Australian Rhino Project on. To start our series, and it just seems like a very good idea to me. I mean, I don't know, other than assigning multiple rangers to every single animal and corralling them into a really small spot where they can always be seen 24 hours a day, which seems hard to do with thousands of creatures. It seems like they really have some problems.
It's a tough one. The one other thing I should mention about the rhino horn issue is, to put a flip on it, looking at the human side of things, if you legalize it, more and more people are going to be using it to treat their illness.
Exactly.
It's not a treatment, so they're not doing themselves any good anyway. The rhinos are going to suffer, and the people are not going to be getting the treatment they actually need.
I really appreciate your time. You're a huge person in what you've done for these animals. I know you probably hear that all the time, but it's really, really impressive. And thank you for coming up with the methodology to keep them alive, to get them back into reproducing. It's Dr. Terry Roth from the Cincinnati Zoo and a major player in the survival of these creatures. They're really adorable, too. When I saw Hairpin, I mean, he's just so disarming and so cute. When you look at his face, you want to give him a big kiss and a hug. You must miss having him around, huh?
We do. There is something about that animal. I hear it from so many people. We had some Sumatran rhinos here for a long time, but Hairpin won everybody's heart. There's just something about him. Yeah, so you are not alone. There are a lot of Hairpin lovers out there.
He's a great ambassador
he is.
For the species.
We do miss him dearly.
I can imagine. Well, we'll stay in touch, and certainly if there's another thing that comes up, I'd like to reach out to you through the official channels, if that's okay. Because I really appreciate your work and getting to talk with you. Thank you so much for making yourself available to Hawaii Public Radio and to talk about this incredible birth. She still doesn't have a name, right?
As far as I know, she does not, no.
Dr. Roth, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Big aloha and mahalo to you.
Oh, thank you, Dave. I appreciate it.
Take care. Be safe.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.